Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, the news, of course. Our series with the New York Times, Work in America, wraps up. And Cesar Chavez comes to the big screen from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 28th of March. Great to have you here, everybody. It's a Friday. You know what that means? No, not that. Well, yes, that. Take the next 2 days off. But also this, a little bit of live radio to summarize the 5 days gone by, our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. For that, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi.
So, John, let me ask you the consumer-oriented question. There was a little bit of consumer news today. Spending is up, but confidence is meh. Give me your general vibe, would you?
I think that people came, you know, part of it is may just be winter depression, right? Mm-hmm. Who of us isn't feeling a little down?
It's like 75 in LA today, yo.
Well, it's actually pretty warm here in New York today, but it's been freezing for a long time on the East Coast, and I think that may have weighed on people's spirits. But also, the economy does have a sort of slowing feeling, and I think people are picking up on that.
Lee, what do you think?
I agree with John. Ooh. I also just, I mean, you know, the weather here is not to be underestimated. And I say that both from a factual standpoint, looking at the numbers, but also just from a just weakened, just haggard perspective. I'm dying to go shopping because it would be more fun sitting inside.
Is there pent up weather
demand?
We haven't
done anything. No one has done anything here all winter. I mean, it's just been too much.
Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing.
So maybe we'll see some spring loaded, like, you know, really, you know, maybe once things change, people will rush out and that will really inflate the numbers unexpected ways. Yeah.
Which would be great. I confess I had not expected you guys to be as humbled by the weather as you are.
But I usually make fun of people.
I know. I was going to make fun of you, but I figured that was bad form.
But but it's true. The weather has been really bad this week.
All right, let's get to something a bit more quantitative. The banks and the stress tests that the Federal Reserve has been doing. The Fed says most of the big banks in this country are okay. But interestingly enough, this past week, they said that Citigroup was not allowed to do a stock buyback and was not allowed to pay dividends, John, because they didn't have enough of a capital cushion. That is to say, if you read between the lines, the after effects of the financial crisis are yet upon us.
Well, yes, but it's not really that they don't have enough capital cushion for Citi. The problem was their capital planning process wasn't good enough.
Okay.
So that's even worse for them. Because it's one thing to just say, look, we still have a lot of losses and, you know, our numbers aren't that good. This was a serious indictment of management, because what they said was that your process for figuring out what your losses might be in a downturn is not any good.
Lee, that seems troubling. Yeah, huh?
It is, especially because, you know, typically the stress tests are kind of, nothing to move here, keep moving.
Right.
And so this was a bit of a surprise. But I do think that overall the tests did show that most of the banks are, you know, in better shape than they were going into the crisis. But this was a jolt for Citi for sure.
All right, fair enough. Let's move into another thing then, Lee, about which you know quite a bit. Housing, Case-Shiller was out this week. The numbers were, you know, fine, basically. They kind of go along with the whole... the economy is flat-ish, right, if housing prices are flattening as well?
Yeah, I mean, those are two great words, fine, basically. I mean, that's kind
that's
what
of
what
I
it's
do,
like.
Words.
But you have to look at, you know, so Case-Shiller is all about prices, but you have to look at two things when you look at the housing recovery, and that's prices and also new construction and even household formation. And those things are still lagging well behind what they were. And so we're still a ways away from that being back up to where it was before. But, you know, we are still kind of – the housing market is recovering, and it is in most markets in this country.
Right, but we have had a huge, huge slowdown in mortgage issuances, and all the banks are saying it's going to slow down for the rest of the year. So I'm not sure house prices are going to keep being fine. They're going to go from fine, not to terrible, but to meh.
Mm-hmm. Meh. Yeah, that's the word of the day. That's the word of this wrap. One more thing. We're going to cram in yet a fourth topic, John, in about another half a minute or so. IPOs. And I'm not a Candy Crush player, but King Digital got a lot of press this week. It went public and did terrible. There's been talk of a tech boom and bubble. Are we done now with the tech IPOs for a bit?
I found this awesomely reassuring. If we were really in a dangerous bubble, King would have just gone through the roof. In 1999, those kind of stocks just exploded after their IPOs. This made me think, people are a little bit more rational, and that's a good thing.
Lee?
I agree with that. And the funny thing, the Candy Crush, I mean, the story here is that it has profits, but it does not have the growth necessarily. And usually it's the reverse. So I think it was a sane reaction and valid
concern. Honestly,
concerns.
How much Candy Crush can one play, right?
Seriously. I've never played one game. So they have one customer. I guess they can still win.
Here's a game for you, John. Look it up. 2048. Look it up.
I'll check it out.
John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. See you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
You too.
All right,
thanks.
Be good. Wall Street today mostly up and then slightly less up. Interestingly, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Speaking of the markets, billboards were a big deal on Wall Street today. Ticker symbol CBSO, CBS Outdoor, went public on the New York Stock Exchange this morning. Did pretty well in its first day of trading, too, because it turns out the billboard industry is pretty profitable, which is interesting, seeing as how it's tough to measure just how effective billboard ads actually are. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
I am driving on Sunset Boulevard, and I'm stopped here at a light looking up at an advertisement that's taken up the whole side of a building, about a 50-foot ad for a show called Devious Maids.
But did anybody notice? I asked 25-year-old Christopher Taylor.
By any chance, did you happen to notice the billboard that you just walked past maybe 20 feet ago?
No, actually, I didn't.
Part of the challenge is to measure the audience that sees any particular billboard.
That's Tuna Amobi, an equity analyst with S&P Capital IQ. Even though there isn't an easy way to calculate the return on advertisers' investment, he says,
there is little question that it is effective. The question is not whether or if they're getting a return, because I think there's consensus in that. The question is to what degree or what magnitude.
So advertisers continue to spend money on billboards, increasingly electronic billboards. But on the downside, some costs of billboard ads are not borne by advertisers. David Corkus lives in a condo where his windows are blocked by a giant ad.
I had one of the best views in LA, and then because of that billboard and the sloppy job they do on putting up the billboard, it's dark in there. I mean, it's depressing.
Have you complained?
Oh, of course. I've talked to management, but they make about $50,000 to $80,000 on that thing. So no matter how much I complain or anyone else in the building, it's not going to change.
Studies have shown that a nearby billboard can reduce property values by up to 30%. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The city of Detroit, the bankrupt city of Detroit, it should be added, is getting ready to start shutting off water to residents who are behind on their bills, which is to say about half of the city's residential customers, 140,000 homes. As soon as the weather is warm enough, crews will head out to about 3,000 homes a week and shut them down. But a lot of businesses are in the red, too, as is the school system and the city itself, which maybe I didn't mention, is bankrupt. Together, they owe more than $50 million, $50 million. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story.
Daryl Latimer leads the Water and Sewerage Department's collection efforts. He says settling up with the city government is a work in progress.
Yes, you have some departments that are behind, some departments that are disputing some of the charges. And in some cases, it's not a clear case cut of who's actually responsible for what facilities.
So Latimer is negotiating. He's also trying to be patient as staff for a new mayor get their bearings.
We were close with the schools. However, we were able to work out an agreement, and they're on schedule with their payment arrangement.
And then there are the commercial accounts. More than a third of the city's business customers are at least 60 days behind for a total of $22 million.
Yeah, it's kind of high, but there's a number of those accounts that are in dispute.
Some business owners say they are being overcharged on a new stormwater drainage fee the city imposed last year. They're withholding payment on just those fees. And that leaves residents. Latimer says he doesn't expect to shut off the water for half the city's households. He thinks some people who can pay just haven't gotten around to it yet.
The water bill is not seen as very important. It ranks behind your gas, electric, and even your cable bill here.
He says since news came out that the shutoffs were in the works, foot traffic has increased at the department's payment centers. Word of the shutoffs prompted Yvette English to seek out help with her bill. Her total, $3,000.
Just got up high. I mean, I wasn't paying it all the time, but whenever I got a chance to pay a little something on it, I did.
$20 here and there didn't make much of a dent. The bill is $85 a month. English has a minimal income. She cuts hair out of her house. She's got three teenage kids, and she was in trouble with the electric utility and the gas company, too.
Yeah, I'll just keep trying to make arrangements with them. I've made a lot of payment plans with them, and some old arrangements I couldn't keep.
The staff at Wayne Metropolitan Community Action Agency is helping her get caught up with the water bill. The agency expects to have $1.5 million to help residents avoid water shutoffs, but there are more than 140,000 households at risk with debts of more than $70 million. Katie Kibbe is the agency's program director. When I asked her about that disparity, she paused.
I don't even know if I have words. It is stunning. I mean, I think of families. I think of children. I mean, water is a basic right. People can't live without water.
In Detroit, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up, from the farm fields to the big screen.
I heard many things, you know. So, like, how can these be told from the angle of a white American? And I go, well, the problem is his name is Cesar Chavez.
Filmmaker Diego Luna coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 58 points today, about a 3%, closed at 16,323, did the blue chips. The Nasdaq struggled early in the day, but managed to close a teensy bit higher, 4 points, a 10th percent, finished at 4155. The S&P 500 grabbed itself 8 more points, about a 0.5%, ended things at 1857. For the week, the Dow managed a 10th percent victory. That is a 10th, not a 10% victory. The S&P sank a 0.5%. The Nasdaq suffered a 2.8% loss as investors sold off what are called momentum stocks in the internet and biotechnology sectors. Speaking of biotech, today was a fitting end to the week. Gilead Sciences shed another 4%. Biogen IDEC dropped 5%. The biotech sector, get this, is down about 13% for the month so far. In fact, the month gone by. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.72%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Take me out to the ball game. It's opening day for Major League Baseball. Travel Centers of America is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. They operate about 150 truck stops around the country. And on March 31st, 1889, the Eiffel Tower was complete. It only took 2 years, 2 months, and 5 days. It's held together by 2.5 million rivets. Took me all morning to count those people. TGIF. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Our collaboration with the New York Times that we've been running this week is called Work in America. Who does it, why they do it, and what kinds of jobs they get. For parents and teachers, even the President of the United States, it's become pretty much a mantra that a college degree is the best road to a lucrative career. Over time, college graduates make more money by far than their non-degreed peers. But for a lot of the 10 million or so people who graduated into the teeth of the Great Recession and its miserable job market, that road has been closed, and they will be paying the price for that for a good long while. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports on what's been called the Lost Generation.
Hi.
Things have worked out pretty well for Kyle Whitaker. He lives on a quiet street outside Baltimore with his fiancée, along with a German Shepherd, a St. Bernard, and a Great Pyrenees. The couple bought this three-bedroom house, complete with white picket fence, last summer. And at 27, Whitaker's got a good job as a systems engineer with a U.S. defense contractor.
It took a little longer than I was expecting to, but, you know, if you ask me, am I happy with where I am given everything, I'm thrilled.
It took time because Whitaker graduated from George Washington University in D.C. in May of 2008 and walked smack into the worst recession since the 1930s. He studied applied mathematics and statistics, among the most lucrative majors out there. But after 6 months scouring job sites, he took the only job he could find, part-time at a Lord & Taylor department store. The pay barely covered his rent.
It definitely hits your self-esteem pretty hard after the first year or so when you realize I have a good degree and I consider myself relatively smart, but it's just not going anywhere.
Things got so bad that for months he ate nothing but cheap angel hair pasta. He thought he might have to move back in with one of his parents. When his girlfriend's old Lincoln Town Car broke down, they left it at a gas station to be sold for parts.
We could barely afford gas at that point, so there was no way to get a tow.
Whitaker is part of a generation of graduates who've had the bad luck to launch their careers in a dismal job market and slow recovery. In 2012, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, almost half of recent college graduates were working in jobs that typically don't require degrees. That compares to about a third of all college graduates. And now many of those new grads wonder if a degree was worth all the effort and expense. At Color Creations Salon in Richmond, Kentucky, Brittany Himes gets some practice washing and styling her sister's hair. This is what she's always wanted to do, and she thought about going to beauty school straight out of high school. But by the time she was a senior, the message had sunk in. A 4-year college degree was a must. And she would be the first in her family to go to college.
It was definitely presented by my teachers and guidance counselors to be something that you definitely had to do if you wanted to be successful in the job market.
So Himes went to Eastern Kentucky University while working full-time and eventually earned a business degree in 2009. After a year searching for an entry-level administrative job, it was back to plan A. She finished a cosmetology program last September. Now at 28, she's making $7.20 an hour as an apprentice stylist with $27,000 in student loans to pay off.
Here I am, and I'm starting at the bottom. I enjoyed college. I enjoyed learning. But in the end, it didn't really amount to much for me. Well, if anything at all.
It's not unusual for college graduates to struggle as they enter the labor market.
Richard Dietz is a senior economist with the New York Fed. He and colleague Jason Abel recently looked back more than two decades and found that it takes a while for brand new grads to settle into careers, no matter what the economy. What's changed in the last decade or so is that the jobs they're settling for are more likely to be low paid or low skill, like restaurant work or retail.
Things have gotten tougher for recent college graduates, there's no doubt.
Making matters even worse, crippling student loans. Natalie Bend graduated from Northern Illinois University in December 2007. She owed less than $15,000, pretty reasonable next to the national average of $20,000 at the time. But when she finally found a job at a domestic violence crisis center, she couldn't afford her payments. So she deferred her loans. The balance eventually doubled.
I would never want to be without work again, just because the thought of my student loans not being paid again or something and ballooning back up to what they were is terrifying.
Bend has a better job now at a financial services firm, but her dream of going to law school, it's on hold for maybe a decade. Recession graduates have put off a lot. Marriage, kids, living on their own. It hurts them, it hurts the economy, and it's hard to catch up.
Where you start affects where you end up.
Anthony Carnevale directs the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University. He says recent grads could pay a penalty all the way through retirement in lost wages, opportunities, and savings for starting out lower on the career ladder.
Where you start essentially leads to the second job, and the second job leads to the third job. So you want to start out in the most advanced position you can find.
But even in a bad market, college still pays. At its worst, unemployment for recent grads was less than half of what it was for young workers without degrees. Carnevale says college graduates generally can expect to earn almost 85% more during their lifetimes than people who just finished high school.
They're not doing as well as they might have done when the economy was in full growth mode, but they do a lot better than anybody else.
6 years after he graduated, Kyle Whitaker would agree. He says he might be doing better had he started his career right out of school. But after several promotions, he's earning enough to manage his student loans and put away some money for retirement. He can even look back on that retail job at Lord & Taylor and find some good in it. When he went in for the interview with the defense contractor, where he works now, he made an impression.
I got in there and I had my nice suit on. I had a pocket square and everything.
He'd bought it with his employee discount. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You can hear all the stories of Work in America, our series with the New York Times, and browse some great pictures as well on our website. If you want even more, download our Marketplace ebook. Just search for Marketplace Reader in the App Store, or better yet, find the link at marketplace.org. This coming Monday would have been Cesar Chavez's 87th birthday. And as important as Chavez was in the history of organized labor in this country, farm labor to be specific, his life story still isn't widely known. Actor Diego Luna is the director of a new feature film about Chavez and some of the milestones of the union that he founded, the United Farm Workers. It's called Cesar Chavez. It opens this weekend. Diego Luna, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
This is, it's an interesting movie on a whole lot of levels. And I guess the place to start is why you wanted to make it.
I wanted to do a film that, I come from Mexico. I was born in Mexico, raised there. I lived there until my work started to make me travel. And I wanted to find a story that would allow me to shoot here and do an American film, but still talk about where I come from, you know. And by looking at or researching about stories to tell, I was impressed, shocked, and surprised that there was no film about Cesar Chavez. And
yeah, this is the first one, right? The first full-length biopic, as they say.
And if you go a little further, there hasn't been a biopic film about a Latino figure that is not part of the entertainment business.
Oh,
as
yeah.
If there was no, like, doctor, civil rights activists, scientists to celebrate, you know? It's it's quite ridiculous if you think about this community that grows and grows and grows, but it's not represented in entertainment, at least not with the respect and the complexity, diversity, cultural richness that it has. And I want to be part of that, you know?
One of the things that makes what Chavez tried to do and did work is the withholding of labor. I mean, the strike in 1965, 66 that he started is the emotional center of this movie, right? The farm workers just not going into the fields until they get what they needed.
And you know what? It started to happen. They started breaking the strikes with workers, you know, with undocumented workers. And they realized that a strike was not going to be the only way, you know, that a strike is a statement that you are willing to sacrifice till the end. Strike is means also I am going to dedicate my time to build something that is more fair. But the tool they started using is the boycott.
Yeah, the great boycott. And that's how, as you have Michael Pena saying in the film, playing Cesar Chavez. That's how we're going to get it from this thing that we're doing to a thing that everybody does.
Exactly. And also it's, I mean, it's about common sense, you know, but I think it shows you that what you have to fight is indifference. That's the main monster we have to fight here, you know, because it's us consumers. We're part of a horrible chain. If we knew, we would not be part of. I mean, I spend a lot of time here now, and I feel I'm part of this. It's very hypocritical, you know?
This was not a big-budget movie. It was $10 million, plus or minus, yeah. Which was raised mostly, I understand, in Mexico. You couldn't get American financing for this movie. What does that tell you?
Hollywood and entertainment business does not like taking risks, you know? So they're not going to... go fight to find this audience and finally feed them. I heard many things, you know. So, like, how can this be told from the angle of a white American?
And I go, well, the problem is his name is Cesar Chavez. You wanna do the film about a reporter that goes and meets Cesar Chavez? No, this man deserves to be celebrated, and it's his community that needs the respect and attention that this film is giving to them.
Cesar Chavez is the film. It's a good one. Diego Luna, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, in which CNN reports a 14-year-old kid in Pittsburgh has found a way to save the federal government $136 million. For a science project, Suvir Mirchandani researched the price of ink and how much of it different fonts, that is, typefaces, use. Anyway, long story short, by changing to the Garamond font, Suvir figures the government printing office could save 30% of its printing costs, the aforementioned $136 million every single year. The GPO said it would think about it. Personally, I'm more of a Times New Roman guy, Calibri sometimes too, but whatever. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on a Friday. Today, the Dow up 58 points, 16,323. The NASDAQ a bit higher, 4 points. 4155, the S&P 500 up 8 points, ended things at 1857. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.